good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. Scott Spears along with you on this Thursday, February the 16th, 2017. 1:14 coming up on 1:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And there's a gentleman I've wanted to have on this program for a long time to get his opinions on things going on in the world today and also thoughts on an amazing life that he has lived. His name is Clarence Jones. He is the former personal counsel, advisor, draft speechwriter, and close friend of Martin Luther King Jr. He is a scholar in residence at the Martin Luther King Jr. Institute at Stanford University, and also the author of What Would Martin Say, 2008, and Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. It is with great honor we welcome to these microphones Clarence B. Jones. Mr. Jones, how are you?
Hi, how are you, sir?
Very good to talk with you. I want to talk a little bit, before we get into the topics of the day, about right. Martin Luther King Jr. What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, you don't have enough radio time for me to tell you. I'll just tell you, I met him when I was 29, and he was 31 last month. I just had my 86th birthday. I can give you a topic sentence, which I repeat over and over when I talk to students. I mean, I talk when I teach or when I lecture. In 12 years and 4 months, from 1956 until April 4th, 1968, the date of his assassination, with the exception of the presidency of Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, Martin Luther King Jr. may have done more to achieve political, racial, social justice, and equality than any other event or person in the 240-year history of the United States. That's who he was.
How was this man...
2017 terms, he was a bad dude.
How was this man, who was not a politician, who was not rich beyond means, do that? How was he able to do that?
Not rich at all, beyond any means.
Yeah. How was this man able to be so transformational?
Well, first of all, he has been popularized, and understandably so, but as a, quote, a civil rights leader. But he would be the first to remind you that before he was a civil rights leader, he was the minister of the gospel. He was a deeply devoted Christian minister. The doctor came from a Ph.D. in theology from the Boston School of Theology. As a Christian minister, as he would say, he could not segregate his moral concerns. Either a matter was morally right or morally wrong. His strength, his inner strength, his confidence in his own ability, and indeed his confidence in the innate goodness of the American people came because of his deep abiding religious teachings, that everybody can be redeemed, that there is within all of us a conscience and a soul, and even the most rabid segregationist, if you have a way of getting him or her to understand the wrongness of their ways, and understand it's another alternative, that they can be reached. And history has validated and confirmed that he was right.
The I Have a Dream speech, everybody knows what it is. You were there when it was coming about. How did that happen?
Well, first of all, the I Have a Dream speech was his speech, the speech that he had worked on a speech the night before, and in fact, more than the night before, a couple of weeks in advance. We were both at the Willard Hotel, and I had been with him. The March on Washington was on Wednesday, August 28, 1963. And he was putting it together, working upstairs in the suite of the Willard Hotel with his wife. And I had an opportunity to see him. And some of his close advisors had come down at the last minute and wanted to offer their opinions of what he should say. He should say this and that shouldn't say. And at the end of the evening, I simply handed him, which I often had done in the past, I would hand him some notes for him to consider to incorporate or by reference as he was preparing a speech. Only in this case, because of the shortness of the time, I actually wrote out a suggested textual material that he might consider using as the opening paragraphs of his speech. I knew he was working on it. I figured it'd give you a point of departure, then you can add or strike out and use whatever you wanted to use. I didn't know until actually he spoke that when he spoke that he was actually going, they actually did use only in the first seven paragraphs, as I figured it out, the suggested text that he considered. And after that, he added his own material, and then even as he was speaking that material from the text, he was interrupted by Mahalia Jackson, who shouted to him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin, tell him about the dream," at which point he takes the written text, sets it to the side of the lectern, and the rest of the speech, you wouldn't know it from listening to him or watching it on the videotape, was all extemporaneous and spontaneous. Thereafter, he made a reference at the end to a note when he wanted to quote in the words of the old Negro preacher, "Free at last, free at last." He made some reference to that, but the entire speech thereafter was spontaneous and extemporaneous.
When somebody becomes a transformational figure, as you say, the more popular they become nationwide, the more people, I don't want to say groupies, but more people want to get close to them, want to get in their ear. Did it become increasingly harder for Dr. King to live his life the bigger he got?
Well, you say the bigger he got. I think just to refresh your recollection of some of your teachers, or some of your listeners, is that in terms of current polling reference, okay, maybe in August 28, 1963, when he gave his I Have a Dream speech, which was really a summon to the conscience of America, asking America to be the best that it could be and so forth, maybe in so-called polling, he was maybe had a 60% approval, okay? After he gave his speech, Time to Break the Silence, on April 4th, 1967, publicly criticizing the war in Vietnam, I would say his approval rating at that time came down to about 30%. He became very unpopular. It was a combination of that speech and then between 67 and 68, when he began to focus more on the question of income inequality and jobs and dealing with the economy. Some civil rights leaders, some persons who had formerly been his public stalwarts and working with him in the civil rights movement, once he began to publicly criticize the war in Vietnam, they turned on him and said, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. They adopted the line essentially that, you know, Martin, you're just a Negro preacher. You don't know anything about foreign policy. Keep your mouth shut. And this is what I said earlier. You know, they forget that as the minister of gospel, he doesn't segregate his moral concerns. For him, the Vietnam War was either morally right or morally wrong.
It's very interesting because he was a human being on this planet, and he was a human being on this planet that you knew.
Yes, that's correct.
Now he is a national holiday. He is taught in schools. At what point do you think that full appreciation happened?
I'm sorry, say that again?
At what point do you think that full appreciation happened where he became an iconic figure?
Well, I think, sometime, I guess it was 1980, 1979, when President Reagan passed a bill commemorating, setting aside a national holiday commemorating his birthday. I can't put my finger on a given date. I would think that people looking back, certainly his contemporaries, who survived and began to appreciate the magnitude of his leadership and the holding of the celebrating his birthday every day as focused the nation on the on him. It's not on Martin King, quote Martin King the person. It's on Martin Luther King Jr. and what he was able to achieve. Not alone, he was able to achieve. achieve it. Remember, African Americans constituted only 12% of the population. He was able to achieve it because he was able to convince the 88% of the population, the majority of white people, that it was in their self-interest that this nonsense of racial segregation end. And so that, putting it, comparing to the South African experience, Martin Luther King Jr. ended American apartheid, ended official racial segregation in the United States. That's what he did. And he got, and he was able to build a constituency among the 88% of the white people who supported it and say, yes, America's better than this. We can be better than this. Let's end this racial segregation nonsense.
You know, no matter whether you are Republican or Democrat, nobody says anything negative about Martin Luther King Jr. And
people do occasionally, but that's okay. Yeah. Nobody's, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, well, it was coming off. I remember a few years ago I was interviewing Dr. Maya Angelou, and right. She said she had a great worry that people had put him in an iconic status and forgotten that he was a human being with flaws.
That is correct.
Yeah.
He was, in fact, and he was, and I say to people, I mean, I was raised as a Christian, as a deeply religious person, not that I hold myself out as being, quote, a deeply religious person, but my early childhood background and training, and so I say to people when I hear them criticizing Martin King or some other religious person, and I say rather humorously and somewhat cynically, I said, well, from my Christian teaching background, the last perfect person I read about or knew, this person walked on water. He allegedly parted the Red Sea. He was betrayed by one of his best friends for 30 pieces of silver, and he was crucified for a crime he didn't commit. Now, that's the last perfect person I know about.
And
his name was Jesus Christ.
He was assassinated, unfortunately. But a lot of people say he felt like that was going to happen. He felt like his life was not going to have a long tenure. Did you feel that? Did you feel that he felt that?
Yes, I felt that he felt that, and there were any number of times. He was the target of lots of animosity and hate, and there came a time when those of us around him, and others can speak for themselves, but for me, when it wasn't a question of whether, in my mind, Dr. King would be killed or assassinated. The only question was when. And I think that he had come to reconcile himself to that probability. Certainly those of us who were close around him, I'd come to say it wasn't a question of when, it's just a question of when.
With that's a big statement, and when you make that...
I'm just telling you, but that's just, you ask me, and that's my honest question, what I believe.
Yeah. With making that statement, when it did happen, what was your feeling?
Well, within the first 10 seconds of learning about it, my first immediate reaction was, they finally got him. That's what I said. They finally got him. I was on my way. I was actually rushing to the airport on my way to go down to Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, and early in New York. And as I was leaving the house, the phone rang. And I said, these phones ring just when I'm... it was something persistent about the ring. I was waiting for a taxi cab. And I said, I'll go and answer the damn phone. And I picked up the phone. It was Harry Belafonte on the other end of the phone. I said, Harry, I can't talk to you. I'm rushing to the airport. He said, well, you got to talk to me. He said, Martin's been shot. I said, what? Yeah, turn on the television. And he hung up the phone. My telephone. I said, oh, my God. And I was about ready, heading to the airport. And I'm thinking about what I'm going to do. And I'm trying, I call in Memphis and trying to get through and so forth. And then Harry Belafonte calls back again. And I said, Harry, I'm trying to get through to Memphis, Tennessee. He says, Martin's dead. And that's how I experienced the evening of April 4th.
Mm. When was the last time you spoke to him?
Last time I spoke with him was on the evening April 3rd, 1968, late in the evening. It was giving me a short rundown of what had happened that day in Memphis and dealing with something of the logistics about my coming down. This is, remember, this is late April 3rd in the evening, New York time, and dealing with the logistics of my coming down the next day, and that somebody was going to meet me at the airport and bring me directly to the church where he was speaking. So it was about, just to be sure, that confirming again that, in fact, I was coming as we... and so on the 4th, when I was leaving house, I was leaving pursuant to, that's what I told him I would do. I was on my way to the airport. Because the last time I talked to him was on April 3rd, late evening.
In the age of conspiracy theories, what do you think happened to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, I have to deal with the facts that we know. He was assassinated. James Earl Ray pulled the trigger of the rifle that assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. Now, there is a fantasy out there promulgated by the Warren Commission and then official commissions. There's a fantasy. They don't put it in as stark terms. I'm about ready to tell you, okay? They want the nation to believe that one day this lone person, James Earl Ray, limited education, he got up one morning and said, today, April 4th, 1968, is the day I'm going to kill that king nigger. That's what they want us to believe. And he did that all by himself. That's the theory. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's a fantasy. The fact is that James Earl Ray did, in fact, pull the trigger of the rifle to kill him. But, as I said, I just had my 86th birthday, and I probably won't live to see it. But the old people of my generation used to say, the truth will out. Murder will out. It won't happen in my lifetime. But as long as I am absolutely convinced that the truth will out and we will find out that James Earl Ray was part of a conspiracy, he was just carried out. And I believe it was grounded in Texas. I believe it was financed by the Hunt brothers. I believe that, okay? Do I have any factual evidentiary proof? No, I have a lot of suggestion. I have a lot of things which all point in the same direction that is more probable than not, that it is more likely that James Earl Ray was acting as the shooter of a conspiracy.
And for people who are not as versed in history, why would the Hunt brothers want to do this?
Well, the Hunt brothers were just at that time where the oil people were leading financiers of segregationist activity. Why would anybody... You have to understand, why would the segregationist South, the recalcitrant segregationist South, want Martin Luther King Jr. murdered? Because he was the mouth of the spear. He was the tipping point. Was the only tipping point. But he had mobilized millions of people behind his movement. Sure, there was Stokely Carmichael. There was John Lewis and Anita Boyington going across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965. And there were, other leaders. Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, they lost their lives in voting registration. They were murdered by the Klan and their efforts to register blacks in Mississippi in 1964. But Martin Luther King Jr. Was the most publicly celebrated because, he had received the Nobel Peace Prize, and he had, just remember, he was the person who was able to touch the conscience of 88% of the population being white, and to get that 88% of the population, and particularly their children and grandchildren, get activated into the so-called civil rights movement to transform this country, enabling the Voting Rights Act, enabling the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and transformative. And so he was a threat. And when he began to speak about the war in Vietnam, and when he began to speak more about poverty, about the need to have a guaranteed income and so forth, he was dealing with the jugular vein of power in America. That's economic power.
One more question here, because I think this is interesting for people people who are interested in history. Talk a little bit about the letter about the Cuban Missile Crisis to President Kennedy.
Well, he felt that it was important to communicate with the president, to offer him a point of view. Obviously, he had developed the Kennedys had an ambivalent relationship with Dr. King, but they developed a certain amount of respect. There are some historians that say that one of the centerpieces of the movement that elected John F. Kennedy was the movement on the part of the Attorney General to get Robert, to get to Kennedy, to get Dr. King released from a jail in Georgia where his life was under threat. And that knowledge became widely celebrated in November of 1960. And there are those who say, at least from the African, there were those that the reason why Kennedy had gotten so much of the African-American vote, where prior to Kennedy, it had either voted substantially Republican or had been split between the Republican and Democratic Party. Remember, to a large generation, an older generation of African-Americans, the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln. But Kennedy's action in getting Dr. King out of jail under circumstances where his life was threatened, and Dr. King's father publicly thanking the president and saying that he's then going to go and try to bring a whole lot of votes to the Kennedy brothers, the election between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon was separated by 120,000 popular votes. There are people who cynically say that half of those 20,000, 60,000 came from Chicago, and that and of the 60,000 votes that came from Chicago, 80% of them came from dead people. But that came from that was the John Daly machine, voting machine, Mayor John Daly in Chicago. But in any event, it was clear that it was unmistakably clear that the Negro, so-called Negro vote, was responsible for the election of John F. Kennedy being president of the United States. And the single most important driving force at that time was Martin Luther King Jr.
You know, Mr. Jones, it's I haven't talked to you since the rise of Donald Trump. When you look at the whole thing, from the time he announced in 2015 until today, what right. do you attribute the rise and election of Donald Trump to?
I attribute it to a widespread awareness of the income disparity and in an economic disadvantage experienced by large segments of the American people, and in this instance, large segments of white middle-class people who, for a combination of reasons, felt that their interest, their ability to be able to feed their families, to be able to have enough money to pay for health insurance, that Donald Trump had persuaded them that, to use Donald Trump's word, that the system is broken in Washington, and that there was the traditional two-party system with special interests. Actually, the election of Donald Trump was a reflection of the emergence of what I call a third party. A third party, what operating, within the Republican Party. So you have the Democratic Party and Republican Party, and you have the Trump, quote, movement within the Republican Party. But Trump represents a third way within the Republican Party. And that compounded by the fact that the Democrats put up a candidate that a large number of people, particularly millennials and other people, questioned, talking about Hillary Clinton. I mean, she had earned, she had the credentials. She had the credentials and the capacity, superbly qualified to be president. But the so many voters viewed her as a representative of the establishment Democratic Party. And the establishment Democratic Party, this time in its election, didn't address the needs of a substantial segment of the American electorate, and didn't conduct itself in a way to inspire traditional voters to come out and vote for it. I mean, Trump won because a significant amount of African Americans, not that they voted for him, although I think he got 13 or 14% of African Americans, but the tremendous significant fall off from African Americans who traditionally voted for Hillary Clinton in key states. That's how she lost those states. And why did she lose the states? Because they didn't, there was no enthusiasm. Okay, now I don't support that. I don't. My attitude is that voting is about power. And I say to my young friends who do a protest but not voting, and not voting, vote is a vote. I want my listeners to hear, I want the listeners to hear this. By not voting, you are voting. Because the only way you change things in America peacefully in the system we live under is by voting. And yeah. Power, as Frederick Douglass said, power can seize nothing without a demand. So this election is a result of significant segments of people who traditionally supported the Democratic candidate supporting Donald Trump, because, in effect, he had convinced them that, yes, the system is broken. And at the end of the day, he's saying, in effect, well, give me a chance. Can't be any much worse than it is. And, of course, he's a showman. He had a, you know, he was so much more widely known than any of the candidates. I mean, sure, everybody knew Hillary Clinton. Everybody knew all the other candidates running for president and so forth. But you got to understand, in this era of internet and social media and television, is that Donald Trump was a household name. He's on television. Everybody knew Trump. Miss Universe contest, as an apprentice. This show, that show, his boxing. He was Barnum and Bailey, and he was a master showman. And a significant number of voters said, "Well, it can't be any worse." That's their attitude. It can't be much worse, so let's give him a shot.
This comes on the heels of the first African American president, a president that Donald Trump was on.
I understand yeah. all that. Yes, it did. But let me tell you something. For those people looking at the choice after President Obama, okay, there was no way. I mean, the Democratic Party was unable to transfer the Obama magic to Hillary Clinton. And the reason they couldn't do that is because Hillary Clinton was a flawed candidate, and the Democratic Party leadership was a flawed leadership, and otherwise they would have been able to inspire significant segments of traditional voting blocks to come out and vote, and those people either did not vote or they voted for Trump. Now the election results speak for themselves. We don't have to argue about that. That's why he's president.
You know, it's interesting, though, because when you go back and look, I agree totally that President Obama's popularity was not transferable to Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely not. Right.
But why did they not dislike the man Donald Trump for his accusations about the birth certificate of President Obama. Not necessarily that they're going to vote for Hillary, but that they just would vote for one of the third party candidates. Why vote for the man who perpetrated that myth?
Well, I can't accurately answer that. I can only surmise. I can only hazard a guess. And I would say the reaction to that was manifested by people who either did not vote, hear what I'm saying, said, I'm not going to vote, or who took the attitude of what I expressed earlier, how much worse can it be? Yes, I believe we have to clean the swamp, because I'm a machinist in Ohio, and I lost my job, you know, and I'm doing two jobs, and my wife is working in a diner, and so forth, and things are not working out, and this man's been a successful business person. That's what we need. We need to have somebody come in and clean the swamp, and I think it's a combination of the fact they just lost patience. They just lost patience with the traditional political approach, whether it be Republican or Democrat. And that's why I think nobody says this, as I'm saying, but you really got three parties, right, operating. You got the Trump movement, you got the Republican Party, and you got the Democratic Party. And it's the Trump movement that controls the White House.
The thing you say...
The Republican Party controls Congress.
Well, it's very interesting what you say, because you say that the people bought into the how much worse can it be.
That's correct.
At the time, President Obama is president. Now, is that a reality or was that a perception? Did President Obama leave?
No, when I say how worse can it be, sure. President Obama, period of 8 years, did extraordinary steps in turning around the economy. But I'm saying to you, it's the unequal playing field of benefits. There were some people under Obama that did extremely well, okay? African-Americans and white people that did extremely well. But there are a substantial number of people under the Obama presidency who didn't do that well and who were still struggling. And there were... you know, we still inherit some of the unresolved problems. I mean, for example, one of my criticisms of Donald Trump, for example, was that such an effective manager, he's going to do this and do that. I'm saying, Chicago, you can't have you. I want to see him take his management and his presidential skills and say, enough, enough. How much more killing and gun violence are we going to have in Chicago? We've got to do something about gun violence in this country. Okay? We got to do something. You can talk about building the wall all he wants. You can talk about doing this, and yes, the stock market is hitting wreck and so forth, but if violence is gun violence, and I know your phones are going to go off the hook about what I'm about ready to say, because people don't like hearing the truth. Okay? Okay? And what it is, a significant amount of that is black-on-black gun violence, young black people killing other black people. Now, is somebody going to call me a racist because I said that? That is an existential fact. That is not an alternative fact. That is a fact in real life. And if the African-American community in Chicago and the civic political leaders in Chicago can't do a damn thing about it, then maybe we have to have the national government go in there and say, enough's enough. Close it down. Stop the violence. Stop the killing.
It's very interesting, because during the campaign, one of the things that was laid on Donald Trump was xenophobic, racist, because of the wall, because of the
right.
backing of David Duke and pretending, or I don't want to say pretending, saying he didn't
right.
know who he was.
Right.
Do you believe he's those things?
I believe that Donald Trump is a pragmatic, complicated person. I believe that I do not believe that Donald Trump is, how can I put it, is fundamentally a racist person. I don't believe that. Okay? He is no different and no worse than an average white business person of his generation. Okay? There, Donald Trump is an exemplar of a whole number of white, 70-year-old white successful business persons, upper middle class, limited day-to-day access with African Americans, doesn't really start out with any basic anti-African American animus, just has limited experience and is subject to all of the other nonsense that goes out, some stereotypes that over the years about African Americans. Okay, he's not, I mean, what average white person in America is not at some stage of their life been the subject of the legacy of slavery and its consequential doctrine of white supremacy? I mean, so I don't know of any, I mean, there's a new generation of white and Hispanic and Asian people coming up that seem to be relatively free of the racist period of the past. But in Donald Trump's generation, it was, I mean, he didn't go out trying to harm African Americans. I mean, sure, he got angry about these people, younger group of African American men, and he went after them, and he went after them in a way that showed total insensitivity to their being black people. I'm talking about the Central Park, whatever these group of people were. But in other words, what I'm saying, I don't start with the assumption that Donald Trump is a racist person. I start with the assumption that he may want to enact policies that, out of ignorance, but not out of malevolence, not out of animus, he may not fully appreciate that certain policies will not be in the best interest of the African-American community. Or he may think, see, he needs African-Americans around him to say, now, Mr. President, you do this, it's going to be helpful. If you don't do this, it's not going to be helpful. But we make a mistake. We make a mistake in throwing around these labels of racist. You know, as I said, I'm 86 years old. Give me a break. I've seen people in the 1980s, stone cold racist, all right? Well, some of those people today, 70 years old, right in the South, they're not racist anymore. They've changed. They've changed. That doesn't mean they may harbor some modest amount of racism, but you got to be real. You got to be real. People change over a period of time. I don't know of any white person in America who was my age, for example, in the 70s. I don't know any white person in America that hadn't gone through a journey of self-realization, of having to shed the virus of racism. I don't know of anybody. As I say, the last perfect person I know walked on water, betrayed by one of his best friends with 30 pieces of silver and crucified for a cross, for a crime he didn't commit. So we got to be careful throwing around this word that Donald Trump is a racist. He's no better or worse than the average white business person his age.
That being said, he is the president, and he's had a rough week with Russia and not releasing his tax returns. What do you make of him now in that situation, and what do you think his 4 years will bring?
Well, what I don't understand, this is the contradiction, what I don't understand is that obviously he's a wheeler dealer, a very successful person, and I don't understand why he doesn't bring these skill sets to the fore, rather than being caught up in what I call sidebar nonsense. You know, he's trapped apparently in a huge ego, and I think he's like, in some ways he's like a teenager that's out of control. But let me be a little more fundamental. I think, for example, this is only Clarence Jones's thesis, I believe, that the reason he doesn't release his tax returns. That has nothing to do with whether it's going to confirm or not confirm that he's as wealthy as he claims to be. It has nothing to do with that at all. I think it has to do with the fact that he's going to have to, the returns will disclose, you know, the liabilities, loans. And I think that there are probably loans on his tax returns that have been made by Russian-controlled banks. That's one of the things I think. I think that there's a lot of financial obligations that not he personally, but through his businesses, and since he's a major stockholder, owner of his businesses, I think that's one of the things. And I think that also I think he operates on the theory of it ain't broke, don't fix it. I've gotten this far this way, doing it my way, and I'm not going to change. You know.
Well, it's interesting because you wrote the book in 2008. What would Martin say?
Right.
What would Martin say about Donald Trump?
Well, I have to be very careful with this. When I wrote What Would Martin Say was about very specific subjects that I very felt comfortable with. So, for me to answer that question, I have to go through the process. Dr. King returned to Stanley David Levison, very close political advisor, along with me, and to some extent later a fellow by the name of Harry Wachtel, but was Stanley Levison and I were the principal, very close political advisors. And on major political issues, he would ask our opinion. He would ask us to advise him orally and sometimes to put it in the form of a memorandum for him to reflect and consider on. So to answer the question, what would Martin say, would really better be answered is, what kind of advice would I give Dr. King today for him to speak about Donald Trump? And my advice to him would be to first to treat Donald Trump as, you know, he is the president until it's proven otherwise, that he'll been, as John Lewis or other people have said, illegitimately elected. He is the president of the United States. And that's a closed question for now. So therefore, we have to decide how we're going to relate to this man. And the way we're going to relate to this man is we have to propose things that he do that we believe we're going to be in our self-interest. And I believe that one of the things that Dr. King would talk to him about would not only, well, would be first and foremost with the question of gun violence. Absolutely. Gun violence, he talked to him about. And secondly, he would talk to him about the fact you're not going to be able to heal the breach that exists in some of our communities between African-American communities and police. You're not going to deal by talking about it. You have to exercise presidential leadership. That means you're going to have to, President Trump is going to have to go to Chicago, he's going to have to sit in New York, he's going to have to sit in Los Angeles and Oakland, and he's going to have to convene the police and the African-American community and say, now hold on. Now we're one country, okay? Now, we need the police. As a matter of fact, you know the irony? Is that the African-American community needs police as much as or more than most communities, because those communities are afflicted with large crime. So they, but he would say we have to find some way of healing this chasm between the African American community and the police. Listen, I have an appointment. I'm afraid I'm going to have to get off the phone because I have to go speak to a group of judges. And
well, I appreciate your time. It was very enjoyable.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye bye. Clarence Jones, he was the former personal counsel, advisor, draft speechwriter, and close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He is a scholar in residence at the Martin Luther King Jr. Institute at Stanford University, and he is the author of What Would Martin Say, 2008, and Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Clarence B. Jones. Very interesting conversation. Hope you enjoyed that. Tomorrow we'll have the Golden Voice Show with Ted Williams at 11 a.m., followed by the Exchange Club, Sean Kraft, Charlie Evers, Marge Hazlett, Ted Williams, Scott Anthony, and myself at 12, and the Faye Bank Charlie Evers Show from 1 to 3 p.m. each and every Friday, TGIF here on WWGH Radio. Don't forget the big wrestling event coming up at the Salvation Army Gym on Church Street, Saturday night, 6 p.m., $10 a seat. All proceeds go to the WWGH Educational Fund, and you will get free pizza and dessert with that $10. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Marion, Ohio, the talking place. Just listen to former star of the Jeffersons and 227, Marla Gibbs.
Where did the name Mom come from? It's so unique.